Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bob Elliott of the comedy team Bob and Ray died last week at the age of 92. Bob and Ray started their comedy routines in Boston, working for a radio station where one was a DJ and one did the news. And they would sort of banter back and forth after the newscast and found that they really clicked and had a lot of very funny things to say. They also would do a little program following the Red Sox baseball games. And sometimes, I love this, because during those rain delays, if you're on the radio during a rain delay, you don't know what to do. And so what could be better than listening to Bob and Ray? They gave us brilliant humor. They went on to national radio, to film, TV, Broadway, and gave us their lovely humor for more than 40 years. The New York Times obituary says together they specialized in debunking gas bags, political airheads, no-talent entrepreneurs, and Madison Avenue hype masters. Their weapon was not caustic satire, but wry understatement. We wanted to pay tribute to Bob Elliott, who was on our show a couple times. The last was just before his 90th birthday. We're going to do that. We're going to hear some of their brilliant comedy. So many people who have never heard them before, when they first hear them, it just clicks and you become Bob and Ray fans. I believe it was Andy Rooney who said, a lot of people think, as I do, that they appreciate Bob and Ray more than anyone else does. I think Bob and Ray fans feel exactly that way. David Pollack will be joining us during the course of this hour, author of Bob and Ray, Keener Than Most Persons, which tells the story behind their 1946 show and on to New York. And Larry Josephson will also join us. Larry is an award-winning public radio producer, and he developed and produced the Bob and Ray public radio show from 1981 until 1986. He developed Classic Bob and Ray, which surveyed their entire career. Both of those gentlemen will be joining us. We will also have the great privilege of hearing some Bob and Ray. So for those of you who have not heard them before, or you can't get enough of certain of their skits, this one is one of their most famous. I thought we would introduce our Bob and Ray tribute with Bob and Ray and then talk about their comedy. This is Slow Talkers of America.
Well, would you sit there now and tell us your name, please?
Harlow P. Whitcomb.
And where are you from?
From Glens Falls.
New York.
New York.
And what do you do?
I am the president and recording
secretary
of the S T O A.
What does that stand for?
Slow Talkers of America. We believe
in speaking slowly,
in forming
your words, thoughts,
our ideas and opinions clearly before
speaking.
We speak. We are here
in New York City,
in the city of New York, attending
a convention.
Our annual
convention.
Membership.
Convention.
Convention.
Bob and Ray and Slow Talkers of America. David Pollack is the author of Bob and Ray, Keener Than Most Persons. He is joining us now. Thank you so much, David, for being with us. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Pleasure.
Pleasure to have you here. And Larry Josephson is also here. He's an award-winning public radio producer, and he developed and produced 26 half-hour public radio shows called Classic Bob and Ray, also developed and produced the Bob and Ray public radio show from 1981 until 1986, and he also produced Bob and Ray, A Night of Two Stars at Carnegie Hall in New York City. Larry, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen,
Thank
for having
you.
Me.
I understand that Slow Talkers of America, when the curtain went down after the first act and the curtain came up, the Slow Talkers of America were still talking, right?
That's that was their great Broadway play, Bob and Ray, The Two and Only.
The Two and Only. You have said that they decided at some point, and I think that's so true of them, that there's this humbleness about these gentlemen, that they had to decide whether to put up with all the showbiz BS or to be true to themselves, and they decided on the latter. That's saying something, isn't it? It's true, I think.
Yeah, they were proud of their work. They did it and went home and were not on all the time or not performing all the time. They had other interests. That's true. But on the other hand, they were loved by Carson, Leno, Letterman, now Senator Al Franken, who wrote the wonderful piece on Saturday Night Live, read the whole show with his partner Tom Davis. And so they had a lot of pride, but they weren't like, you know, a typical showbiz comedian who's always on.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about how they started, because it's really interesting. They found out at this station in Boston early on that they were kind of on the same wavelength, David.
Yes, they both arrived there after World War II. Bob had actually worked there prior to the war. And this is 1946. Bob had a morning record show, just a, you know, your typical disc jockey, among many other tasks at the station,
mm-hmm.
you know, reading farm reports,
right.
and,
sure.
hosting other shows. And both he and Ray, all they ever wanted to be were announcers. It seems sort of crazy to think of that today, because we don't even really think of announcers that much. But in those days, in the early days of radio, they were sort of larger than life figures. And Bob had this record show called Sunny Side Up, and Ray read the news every half hour. And they just, after the newscast, Ray started hanging around, and they would just started kibitzing on the air, and it just sort of caught on.
Mm-hmm. And it was all improvised, obviously, then.
Yes. Yeah, there was no budget for any kind of writers or anything like that. And they just started kibitzing, and it caught on. And ultimately, when the station landed the contract for the Boston Red Sox games, and also the Boston Braves were there at the same time, they wanted to have a pregame show, and based on the popularity these two guys were getting in the morning, they put them on before the ball games. They had it was about a 20-minute warm-up show, and they just continued spoofing radio shows. That was all they really knew to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of lasted through their entire career. Every bit, when you boil it down to its essence, was mocking broadcasting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, if they could be mocking broadcasting right now, what would they be able to do? There's something about, I like Andy Rooney's comments, Larry, about that every generation or every person seems to think, oh, I found this person, and I think they're funnier than anybody else thinks they are. But there's something about when we discovered them through public radio, it brought Bob and Ray to a whole generation. And I think this is going to go on for a long time. There's certain people you want to keep alive because their comedy goes beyond time, and it speaks to people of so many different ages, doesn't it?
Yes, and one of their most famous soap opera parodies is called Mary Backstage Noble Wife, which is a spoof on a soap opera my mother used to listen to called Mary Noble Backstage Wife. But the point is, you don't need to know about the radio show to get the joke. I mean, you don't have to have any of the antecedents that they use to parody. it stands on its own.
Mm-hmm. And how would you describe their kind of comedy, David? A gentle kind of comedy, but a very intelligent kind of comedy, don't you think?
Yeah, I would describe it as ludicrous premises done totally straight. They were really I don't know that they were the only performers to do that, but there weren't many around. You know, during the golden days of network radio, the big shows like Bob Hope and Jack Benny and Burns and Allen, Fibber McGee and Molly, you know, all great shows with big studio audiences, big orchestras, and studio audiences. And then Bob and Ray came along on the network in 1951 as all those comedians were leaving for television. And so the listener really had to pay attention. You know, there was no studio audience to telegraph what was funny.
Mm-hmm.
The listener had to determine what was funny. And there also was never a sense of the two really striving to be funny. Their sort of
right.
their lack of
yes.
phony affability and slickness sort of set them apart from the very institution they were making fun of, and yet were still a part of.
Yes, how true. And you brought them to another generation, Larry, when you brought them to the Bob and Ray Public Radio Show for a number of years. Tell me about how that came about.
Well, I produced a conference for public radio producers and managers out in Glen Cove, Long Island in 1981. And we had a tradition, this is the third one of them, we had a tradition of inviting someone to perform at this conference. The Firesign Theater did one of them, John Houseman did one, and we were sitting around thinking, what will we do for this year? And the idea came up, Bob and Ray, and they very nicely came out and did a half-hour show. And my producer at that time played the sound effects carts. And they were a big hit among kids who were really 25 to 30. And so I said, well, let's put them back on the radio. So I called them up at their office the next day. And I said, look, I want to put you on NPR. And they said, what? They never heard of NPR.
Oh.
And I offered them a small advance to hold the contract, and they said, I'm going to put you back on the radio. And I said, yeah, kid, sure, go ahead. Because they didn't, had a morning radio show in New York for many years, so they know who I was. But anyway, so I took it to NPR. We did, I think, six shows or eight shows in RCA Studios in New York before a live audience. And I took it to NPR, and they bought it. And that was the beginning of, you know, a long arc that went to Carnegie Hall that's resulted in 96 CDs that are available at bobandray.com. And it just went on until Ray was too sick to work.
Mm-hmm.
And then one more thing.
Sure.
I started asking the fans, either on my website or in the albums themselves, to send in Bob and Ray tape. And a lot of people took the microphone of their old Wallensack tape recorder, put it up next to the speaker, and recorded Bob and Ray. In fact, the quality of those things is not bad. And so we put together all these albums, and we now have a flash drive that has 1,837 Bob and Ray routines.
Oh,
on it.
My gosh, are you serious? 1,837?
That's right.
Woo.
And they're still coming in, too. I've said we have more stuff coming in.
What a body of work. Let's hear another one. This one you sent to us today. I've heard it before. It's very funny. It's the ginger ale salad. Do you want to set this up for us?
Well, there was a longtime radio personality, a woman named Mary Margaret McBride, who was kind of pretentious. And so they came up with Mary Magoon. And Mary's voice is done by Ray, who's a beautiful falsetto. But Mary is going to give you a recipe for a frozen ginger ale salad.
Well, it sounds so good. Here it is.
Hello again, everyone. This is Mary Magoon. It's so good to talk to you all again. Well, now that it's time that we all think of food and so forth, I thought I should like to talk briefly about a favorite salad of mine. I know that salads are playing an ever-increasing role in serving of foods in fine restaurants and so forth. That's why I have today a favorite recipe of mine that I'd like to give you all now. It's called frozen ginger ale salad, and this is how I make it. First, you take a huge crock, and I fill it with the contents of a quart bottle of ginger ale. Either pale or golden makes no difference. You just pour it in. Then I take a head of lettuce, Boston, or iceberg, or romaine, and I shred that and put that into the crock containing the ginger ale. Then I swish it all around until it's thoroughly swished. I get to giggling on that. It's so much fun. You can wear a rubber glove if you so choose. Now, after it's thoroughly swished, I take a marshmallow and I cube it. And that will keep you busy. And after that's been cubed, friends, you put that in, too. Then I take a chocolate bar with almonds, and I remove the almonds and break the chocolate up into little bits and put that in, too. Then I swish it all together. And when it's completely swished and settles down a little into the crock, I pour it off into a mold made in the likeness of a dear friend of mine. Then I take it up and put it in the freezing compartment of my refrigerator. Now, after it's hard, and you can tell when it's hard because it will be hard when you touch it, you see, you take it out, and you chip it into individual servings, serve it with Argyle sock sauce, and garnish with pimento. Well, that's about it. You serve that to your family, and I know they'll really appreciate it. It's a dish fit for a king.
David, there's something just so offbeat, but so ingenious about that.
Yeah, well, you can believe it, I think, is what you're putting your finger on. You know, we were making the point earlier, both Larry and myself, about how convincing their characterizations were. And it all stemmed because they themselves were such authentic guys. They weren't real show busy. In fact, there was no real on-air persona of Bob Elliott or Ray Goulding. I mean, they had, you know, as themselves, I mean, they had barely heightened on-air personas, and they were sort of easy company. They didn't pander to the audience or force themselves on the audience. And it had the sort of same effect on their characters. This authenticity had the effect of sort of legitimizing the characters. They seemed authentic. Each was kind of rooted in its own in his or her own reality.
Mm-hmm.
That they were never cartoonish. So you can believe Mary and her frozen ginger ale salad.
Yeah, and this easiness about them is, you can see it even though, and I think they made a great transition to television. I think they're funny on TV. I was watching some old Johnny Carson and David Letterman skits last night, but they also just seem easy to be with, comfortable guys on those big-time television shows too, don't they, Larry?
Yeah, I have to object. I think they are radio people first and foremost. They did, of course, the great SNL satire, Bob and Ray, Jane, Lorraine, and Gilda in 1979. But I really believe they're radio people. And what they did is they sat next to Carson or Letterman or whoever and did their radio skits. So and they could have made a very good living, both of them, as announcers, straight announcers, because when they do commercials or fake commercials, they sound like very good radio announcers.
We're paying tribute to Bob and Ray and to Bob Elliott in particular, who died last week at the age of 92. We had a chance to interview him a couple times on this show, and he was just generous. And it was as though he was amazed that people knew who he was, even though for more than 50 years they entertained people mostly on the radio, but also on stage and on television. We're hearing some of their comedy. We're speaking with Larry Josephson, who's an award-winning public radio producer, and he developed and produced the Bob and Ray Public Radio Show, also their show Night of Two Stars at Carnegie Hall in New York City. And David Pollack is the author of Bob and Ray, Keener Than Most Persons, which covers from 1946 to early TV in New York to their success in the ad game, to their Broadway show, to Saturday Night Live and The Tonight Show and beyond. And we'll welcome some phone calls. We have a busy hour. For those of you who are Bob and Ray fans, we would love to hear what you... I can't believe they did so much work, 1,837, and probably more than that. So there are some that are favorites of yours. We're just playing the ones today that we know are favorites of a lot of people's. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number is 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It was our great pleasure to have Bob Elliott on a couple of our programs, and we wanted to hear his voice again as we pay tribute. So this is Bob Elliott right before he turned 90 years old. It was just a couple of years ago because he died at the age of 92. He didn't grant many interviews, but he kind of liked us, and we really liked him. So here's a bit of what he had to say when I asked him about starting in the business.
Well, we the WHDH where we worked in Boston acquired the baseball games right toward the end of the war, and they had new management, and it was the management, Bill McGrath mainly, was developing new shows, and baseball then was mostly in the daytime, And we had both the Red Sox and the Braves there to begin with. And he wanted a show that would create a little following before the games each afternoon. And we'd been kibitzing back and forth on the morning time where I had a record show and Ray did the news. And he said, why don't you try doing this off the cuff stuff just before the ball games, and we did, and that became Matinee with Bob and Ray. And he gave us a organ piano team of live music, and we all four had a good time at it. And in the fall, he just kept it on and called it Matinee with Bob and Ray.
And all of the marvelous characters that you did were spontaneous, or did the two of you sit over a legal pad and figure out all of these characters?
No, we just have to look around us. And
they're all around.
In any radio station in those days, the late 40s and the 50s, there were different types of people who came in and out. There was a woman's show every morning, and that was where we adapted that particular character into Mary Magoon. Obviously, the name was close to Mary Margaret McBride. It was Mary Margaret Magoon, actually. And there was a farm director, and if you think of some of the things we did, you'll recognize that they were patterned after people around us. Wally Ballou was really the morning janitor, and we developed him into the character he was. Television was just being born when we came to New York in 1951, and they put us on the network. First time anybody had been allowed to go on the air without a pre-okayed script. And they took a chance. They knew what we'd been doing in Boston. And so we did radio all hours of the day. And out of that came the office to do the talk shows, although we also did our own 15-minute TV show in the early 50s, but radio always appealed to us more. But out of the start we got, we created a name fairly quickly, and we got requests for appearances, including Carson and Parr and all the others.
Bob Elliott talking about their early years. David, what's striking about that is when he said that you look around at the station or you just look around at people and there's your material. It's all around us in life, huh?
Yeah, but they would guess they were just incorporating the staff there at WHDH.
Right. And Wally Ballou, that was one of Bob's famous creations. I had forgotten, actually, when he said that it was Wally Ballou was really a janitor at the station?
No, I think the characterization.
Oh, okay.
The name Wally Ballou, they actually got from Ballou Hall at Tufts University, where Bob's mother worked. That's where they got the name Ballou.
And tell us about Wally Ballou.
Well, he was an inept reporter who would cover such events as, interviewing the owner of a pari-mutuel cat racing track or a gentleman who ran a rabbit farm who described how through training and diet, watch rabbits are being bred to protect property and chase off intruders. All these sort of ludicrous premises. And Ray, too, had a reporter character, Artie Skirmelhorn. And they were just two inept guys, two inept reporters out covering a story. Wally was famous for always missing his cue and being upcut, so the listeners never heard the opening.
Right.
Remarks that he made, so it was always Ollie Ballou speaking from wherever he happened to be.
We have phone calls coming in. Let's welcome some of them. 800-486-8655 is our number. Dave in Grand Chute. Hi, Dave.
Hello. I taught music at one of the UW colleges for quite a while, and every year I would play for my sophomore music theory class the thing about Bob and Ray calling Beethoven's Fifth Symphony like baseball announcers. Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah, I think, is that a routine where they, almost in a, I'm trying to think of the name of the guy who used to broadcast the opera.
P.D. Kubach.
P.D. Kubach, yeah. It was one of his things.
Oh. Like the conductor raises the baton, and is that what you're referring to?
Well, I couldn't hear that last part.
The conductor raising his baton.
Well, I remember he's talking about there's a little oboe solo in there, and they freaked out because he thinks it's an oboe concerto and so on. But it starts by saying it's a beautiful night. There's not a cloud in the auditorium and stuff like that. But it's just hysterical.
Mm. We'll have to listen to that one. Thank you so much, Dave, for the call. This one will go to you because you can help Jeanette out, Larry. Jeanette on Facebook says, how sad, tried to get CD or tapes of Bob and Ray at the Milwaukee Public Library, and all they seem to have is one LP. I wish I could listen again to their humor. How would somebody do that?
Well, they would go to Bob and Ray, BobAndRay.com, and not only can you order 96 CDs, but we're on iTunes and just about every, and there's this flash drive I spoke of with all of our Bob and Ray, nearly 2,000 bits on it. So one way or the other, they'll be available for the foreseeable future, if not forever.
Eileen is joining us next in Madison. Hi, Eileen.
Hi, thank you so much for this. I didn't realize that he had passed away, and I happened to hear your program. I was a listener in the late 50s and early 60s, and always appreciated their sign-off about hang by your thumbs and stuff. But I also recall, it probably was during their television program, I think they did a skit that they were at, I think, a cranberry festival, and it was an in-the-street interview that they were doing, as you just talked about the interviews. And I think there was a fire burning in the background, and they were completely ignoring it, and I'm wondering if your guests have comments about that.
David?
Well, yeah, that certainly falls into the Wally Ballou category, where I spoke about how he was inept, and that was an example of a routine they did over the years, where Wally is out on the street and misses the bigger story for the little story.
And then you said that there are 96 CDs. Are there also DVRs? I would like to have the actual programs and stuff. I love the CDs, but I've tried to find them bookstores, Barnes and Noble, and things. But I'm wondering if Amazon has them, or if email, or any of the.
Larry, you can.
Larry would know. Yeah, Larry.
All of our CDs are available on Amazon.com.
They are, okay.
And also
DVDs,
we're on iTunes.
Too?
Well, they're CDs. They're not DVDs. DVDs are for video.
Yes.
They're CDs. And we also have iTunes has all of them. And there's this flash drive that has 1,837 Bob and Ray routines, which is not all of them that they did by any means.
I guess it was the videos, because the characterization of it's such a visual experience to see those guys out on the street, but I'll just keep trying. But thank you so much for the program.
If you go, I went to YouTube last night, and the Cranberry episode is on YouTube, so you can there too.
Oh, wonderful. Then I can just get it on there. Okay, thank you, Kevin.
All right,
okay.
Thanks very much for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. You spoke of many of the comedians who really enjoyed them. The other person that you have written about who really enjoyed Bob and Ray was Kurt Vonnegut. What did he say about them? Why did he like them so much? David?
Kurt Vonnegut wrote an introduction to one of their books. They had three books out, which were compilations from the written scripts, some of their written routines. Not to get ahead of ourselves here, but if we want to talk about the written scripted routines from writers as differentiated from the ad-lib ones,
right,
we can do that if that's what you'd like. But in that book, he wrote an introduction to them, and I don't have it in front of me. I can't remember the exact quotes that he wrote, but I know that he was a big fan.
And others? Yes, go ahead.
Well, Kurt's sense of humor and of the absurd is very close to Bob and Ray's.
Hmm. And we are going to hear another of their comedy pieces. This one, I'm playing the ones that are famous because there's a reason that they're famous. There are so many of them, but these are way up at the top of the list. Bob and Ray, as we pay tribute to Bob Elliott, who was on this show a couple times, and we loved having him as a guest, died last week. Their humor span some 50 years, which is incredible, and it's just our way of saying thank you for all of the laughs, and we hope to keep your humor alive. Bob and Ray, this one is the Komodo Dragon.
You're listening to the words of an expert, and that's one thing we have plenty of here today, our experts. We're delighted to have with us the world-renowned Komodo Dragon Authority. From Upper Montclair, New Jersey, Dr. Daryl Dexter. Dr. Dexter, would you tell everybody all about the Komodo Dragon, please?
The Komodo Dragon is the world's largest living lizard. It's found on the steep-sloped island of Komodo in the Lesser Sunda chain of the Indonesian archipelago and nearby Rinja, Padaran, Flores. It's a ferocious carnivory, and one swipe of its tail can render an enemy senseless.
Where do they come from?
The Komodo dragon, the world's largest living lizard, is found on the steep-sloped island of Komodo, hence its name. And that is in the Lesser Sunda chain of the Indonesian archipelago and the nearby islands of Rinja, Padar, and Flores. We have two in this country, two Komodo dragons, which were given to us some years ago by the late former premier of Indonesia, Sukarno.
I believe I read somewhere where a foreign potentate gave America some Komodo dragon. Is that true?
Yes. The former premier of Indonesia, Sukarno, gifted this country with two Komodo dragons, world's largest living lizards, some years ago.
Part of the Komodo dragon skit, which reminds us always to listen. I guess some politicians should pay heed to that as well. I think that's a very, very funny skit. It's one of my favorite ones. Do you enjoy that one?
Yes, yeah. Bob told me how that actually came about.
Oh, really?
Bob got a tape one day from a friend in San Francisco of an interview on some random subject. I can't even remember what it was. But the dynamic of the interview was the exact same premise of the Komodo dragon, where the interviewer obviously not paying attention. So they just switched it from whatever that subject was in San Francisco to a whooping crane. And they did an interview about an authority on the whooping crane. And they did one on President Martin Van Buren and the California sea otter and the Komodo dragon. All it entailed was going to an encyclopedia and looking up about four or five facts about the Komodo dragon. There's no jokes in the routine.
No,
it's all in the byplay of the two characters. In fact, there were no jokes in any of their teams, in their routines, really. They weren't about doing straight lines and punch lines. It was all about the characterizations and the premises.
Mm-hmm. Do you have favorite routines? I know you said that some we won't have time for all of them, but do you, Larry, have ones that you like to play every few months?
Besides the Komodo dragon and the slow talkers, is the McBeebe twins, who are identical twins, Claude and Clyde McBeebe, and they say exactly the same words a half a second apart. And it's very funny, but it's also very hard to do.
Yeah, that is a funny bit.
I recently was at a nostalgia convention in Baltimore a few months back, and I ran the only time, to my knowledge, that they ever did the McBeebe twins on television, which they did on the Saturday Night Live show they did, which I think is in Larry's inventory, too, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
And it got screams from this audience just seeing them, you know. They did a sketch with the female members of the Saturday Night Live cast at that time, Jane Curtin and
Gilda Radner.
Gilda Radner.
Mm-hmm.
What the skit was that the two women were trying to separate them so that they could get them to talk without doubling up, and they couldn't do it. I mean, would you mind coming in here? Would you come in the kitchen? No, they kept talking together, almost.
Let's go to Ned in the Upper Peninsula. Hi, Ned.
Hi there. Very pleased you're doing this. I'm a big old-time radio fan, and Bob and Ray are one of my favorites, and they're the tip of the iceberg. The one, many of them, but there's one that's along the same lines as the Komodo dragon and kind of scientific, but it was something about, and I'm going for Mr. Science or something, where they were talking to, interviewing a person on, in regard to how a gas refrigerator works with a flame and then how you make it cold, and that just went on and on. Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah, it sounds like Mr. Science.
That was it. Yep.
Which was a spoof, of course, of Mr. Wizard, which was on television for decades, probably. And Mr. Science was a routine that a writer, Tom Cook, devised. He wrote for the team starting at about, in the mid-50s, they were doing a 45-minute show every day on Mutual plus Monitor on the weekends.
Ooh.
And doing a four-hour morning show on WIN.
Oh, my goodness.
So they needed writing help. And,
what a workload.
Tom was just passed away about a year ago, I guess. He came up with a number of routines, and Mr. Science being one of the more popular, which was just a spoof of the Mr. Wizard series with an over-exaggerated little kid reacting to all the experiments, saying, right, "Holy dang, Mr. Science, I didn't know about that."
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for the call. We're remembering and paying tribute to Bob Elliott of Bob and Ray. He died last week at the age of 92. And we're, many of you were big fans of his, so you're calling in with your tribute to the comedy team. As we also have as guest, David Pollack, the author of Bob and Ray, Keener Than Most Persons. Larry Josephson, award-winning public radio producer, who developed and produced the Bob and Ray public radio show from 81 to 86, and also produced Bob and Ray, A Night of Two Stars at Carnegie Hall in New York. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Bob was with us on a couple of our programs. The most recent was just in 2012, and here's just a little portion of that interview. We'll go back to your phone calls in just a moment. Bob Elliott. I'm wondering if you were funny as a child.
I think if you ask my late parents, they would probably say I was. I don't remember being particularly funny, but I guess I said the good thing that, like you remember, and I didn't really ever plan to go into comedy, but it, when I met Ray and we began to work together, it just it fell into place. And like many teams, I think it started by accident, and we never planned to be a team. It just turned out that way.
Back to phone calls. Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Mike.
I was a young man, 1955, got out of the Army, went to California. I grew up in the sticks in Florida, never listened to much radio. Got a night shift job. I'd wake up at 3 in the afternoon or something, and I heard this radio program. And I'd say, gee, this is a strange program. And this went on for weeks, and I didn't realize that it was comedy. And when I found out, I have never laughed so hard in my life. They had totally had me fooled and roped in. And I've never forgotten it. I've never forgotten them. They were geniuses. They really were.
I love it when people just laugh when they just think about their comedy, David.
It sort of goes back to my earlier point that you had to pay attention.
Yes.
Because, there was no studio audience telegraphing, what was funny. I first heard of them on the air when I was in the eighth grade, when they were on NBC in the mornings. And then when I was in the Army as a teenager, I was 18, I happened to be stationed in New York, and I would go and watch them record their bits for a monitor on NBC and their Daily Mutual show. And then I would sit there watching them, ad-lib these soap operas. In those days, they did a thing called The Life and Loves of Linda Lovely, which was exactly the same as Mary Backstage, A Noble Wife, the same characters, the same plots, but sort of an inside-out version of different names on the characters. And I couldn't believe these two guys just sitting there doing this with no script. I had to sort of close my eyes to get the same visual images I would have as a listener at a home to get the full impact of it.
Mm-hmm. And Larry, do you remember when you first heard them?
Yeah, I did a morning radio show in New York in the 60s, and I heard them when they were doing a morning show, I think on Wins, and my clock radio was set to that station, so I'd wake up listening to Bob and Ray. I'd like to tell you about one other thing, which is very important. They made delicious fun of Senator Joseph McCarthy.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up.
In a part of his was called Commissioner Carstairs, and Ray got him perfect. Point of order. Ray got him exactly, and it took a lot of courage to do that in the 50s, particularly if you're in broadcasting and people are getting blacklisted and so forth. It was brilliant, funny, and courageous.
Mm-hmm. Did they
a CBS newsman who got viciously attacked by Jack O'Brien, a columnist in the New York Journal American, for defending Ed Murrow, who was, on his CNN show, broadcast the whole McCarthy, took on McCarthy, who was ultimately censured in the Senate, and Don Hollenbeck, who was the CBS newsman who was attacked, ultimately committed suicide.
Goodness.
It was really touchy a period.
Yeah, it sure was. Thank you so much for your call, Mike. You made me laugh just by hearing you laugh. Mike in Milwaukee, hi.
Yeah, hey. I was 16, I think, in 1970. I had never heard of Bob and Ray, and I watched them on Johnny Carson. And I didn't know that this routine had a name, but Johnny Carson set them up as the almost identical twins. And he just started asking him questions, and they ad-libbed the answers, and one guy right behind the other. And I've been a Bob and Ray fan ever since. And you are right. That is so incredibly hard to do. I can't tell you how many times I've tried and failed to pull that off, and it is absolutely hilarious. I think, for me, the underpinnings of their humor is the absolute flat affect. There is no joke. There's no selling of a joke.
Right.
There's no cues as to what's funny, and it's just hilarious.
Yeah, thank you so much for the call. And I think we have that skit with us here. Or another thing, the twins. We'll have our guests describe what it is. But this may be just what you're talking about.
Bob and Ray on the music scene now, as we bring good news to a lot of you older listeners with memories that go back to the great Irene Clemming Getchell Orchestra. Here with us are the McBeebe twins, and I just want to let you fellas tell us the story, because it's a real thrill what you have to say, and
well,
I know a lot of music fans will welcome it.
Yes, Bob, it's a big thrill for us to be here
and to bring you the wonderful news that we bring.
We have obtained through the executives of the late Irene Clemming Getchell permission to use all her old arrangements and her instruments, bandstands, uniforms, and gowns.
How hard is it to do that, David?
I would imagine pretty hard. I mean, Ray was, as you can hear there, Ray was leading the way, and Bob just a fraction of a second behind him. But they had been doing that for a long time. And, as both Larry and I have both pointed out, these bits go way back a lot of years.
Right.
You know, he was making the point, too, about how believable and joke-free these routines were, and I used to, sitting in a room when I was doing the research for the book, the Bob and Ray book, I had to reconcile in my mind that this is the same guy who did all those played Wally Ballou and Mr. Science and Biff Burns and all those characters. He's so soft-spoken and even-keeled and, very, very dry. Very normal, I would say.
Very normal, yeah. And very kind. There was something kind about...
Absolutely no trace of any showbiz sweat.
Right.
I'd like to make the point that they were kind, but their characters weren't.
Mm-hmm.
Their
yeah.
characters were mean, stupid, braggadocio. I mean, that's where the bitterness and the, for example, remember Strike It Rich in those shows? And some woman would come on needing an iron lung for her husband, and instead she got a set of chrome-plated wire wheels.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, the satires could be, they could be vicious sometimes. What Larry's referring to is a routine that called Hard Luck Stories, where they would award a prize to some poor, unfortunate soul that was in need of a delicate medical operation or was penniless, and they would supposedly comb the bus stations looking for these down-and-out lost souls and give them these totally inappropriate gifts.
Mm-hmm.
It was based, that was, to Larry's point, was a satire on a show called Welcome Travelers that Tom Cooke had actually worked on.
But it was based on Queen for a Day and Strike It Rich, which were on television in the 50s.
Yeah, but where Tom got the idea was on the very show. In his mind, he was spoofing the very show he worked on, which was Welcome Travelers. But Larry's right. Strike it rich, Queen for Day, were based on the exact same premise.
Mm. Well, thankfully, there is so much material to enjoy, so much material. And I thank you, gentlemen, both so much for being with us to remember Bob Elliott. I was on vacation when I heard he had died. And, you know, it's one of those deaths you just go, oh, no. I was sorry to hear that. And he was great. They were great comedy. And thank you for devoting a big chunk of your lives to remembering them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen.
It's a real pleasure.
Thank you.
And they will live forever at bobandray.com.
Yes, they will.
And in Bob and Ray, keener than most persons.
I love the title.
By the way, Kathleen doesn't start with their radio career. It covers their boyhood.
Oh, great. Okay.
World War II service.
All right, yeah, which is important as well. David Pollack, Bob and Ray Keener Than Most Persons, the book, Larry Josephson, who was their public radio producer for so long.